Seems like we're finding more and more invasive plants in our Wisconsin landscape, and we'll be talking about ways to identify and control them today. Larry Mueller here. A couple of guests for you. First, Kelly Kearns, the Invasive Plants Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR. Kelly, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, and Mark Renz. Mark, back once again as well. He's a UW professor and UW Extension weed scientist. Mark, great to have you back as well.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
So we'll talk invasive plants for a while, and you may have some invasives on your property, or may have some questions about controlling them, or just general plant questions about invasives. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And this is Invasive Species Awareness Month. I think it's a good, probably good time of the year, Kelly, to talk about and, you know, make people more aware of these. And we've got a Wisconsin Invasive Species Council and, of course, the DNR working, I imagine, together on this. What's that council like?
So the Wisconsin Invasive Species Council is actually a governor-appointed council, and it was statutorily created, and it is there to advise the DNR on any kind of rulemaking related to invasive species and on any kind of other survey work or other things that DNR needs guidance on. And it includes representatives from five state agencies, such as Department of Ag, Tourism, and then it also has at-large people as well.
Okay, so, and probably a website and a place to go if you want to find out some more about that council, for sure. Mark Renz, when we talk about invasive plants, and I think I've asked you this the last time you were on, but how do you define an invasive plant?
Well, that's a great question, and I think there's a lot of confusion surrounding what an invasive species is, and we're going to focus on plants today. Kelly and I are plant people, so we're excited about that. But it's really a few simple characteristics. It has to be a species that is not native to the area you're considering. So in this case, not native to Wisconsin. It also has to be a species that is causing or has the potential to cause some type of harm. That could be an economic harm, environmental harm, or even in the case of wild parsnip or some of these other species, harm to human health, too. We even have some situations where there's some agronomic weeds that we could call invasive because of that.
So the worst ones in Wisconsin are what?
That's a loaded question. I mean, it all depends on the environment. We have lots of really problematic species. We have some new ones that are invading that we're really concerned about, and we have some ones that are well established and continue to be difficult to control. I don't know, Kelly, do you have a top five?
I think it totally depends on where you are and, you know, what kind of concerns you have in your situation. You know, right now, what we seem to get a lot of calls on is what's ever blooming at the time.
Yeah.
So right now it's wild parsnip. It's blooming on roadside, so we get a lot of calls on wild parsnip. And so it really depends on kind of what's out at the time and what people notice.
You don't want to be going out there picking wild parsnip.
Not with your bare hands, no.
Not with your bare hands anyway. Well, we have many callers online with questions already, so let's just take a call. Ann and Hawkins, will go to you first. Ann, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm concerned. I have we planted a little prairie area. It was invaded with horse weed. We got rid of that, and now it's completely engulfed with goldenrod. And we also have mugwort growing all over.
So you're wondering how the heck to get rid of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Without using chemicals, if possible.
Mark Renz, let's turn to you.
Yeah, and so goldenrod is really common, particularly in some of these prairies. It gets involved, it gets in there, and it can really spread and be problematic. It depends on what the goldenrod species is. We have many native goldenrods. I don't know if, Kelly, if you know, I think we have dozens of native species.
Yeah.
But it's likely we have several non-native, like Canada goldenrod, and that's probably my guess is what it is. But it'd be important to get that goldenrod identified. It may actually be a beneficial plant that you want to have in there. As far as control of goldenrod, it's a creeping perennial species. It's really challenging to do without chemicals, but I have heard people have some mild success at suppression if they can mow those plants after they just start to bloom. It's not going to kill it. It's going to knock it back, I would say, 50 to 70%, and in 2 and 3 years, you're going to have to do it again. The big bad news is if you have your blooming wildflowers at that time, it's going to cause a problem. Kelly?
But if you're in a small enough site, it sounds like you might have a small prairie garden. You can just keep continually hand pull and keep trying to pull that up. You will get part of the roots, but you won't get the whole thing, so you will get resprouting. But if you really don't want to use herbicides and it's mixed in with other things, hand pulling or even just going in there and weed whacking might be helpful.
What about mugwort? I don't know mugwort.
Yeah, I'm guessing it's motherwort is what you have. Is that Anne, or is it mugwort?
No, it's I've identified it. It's mugwort. So
one of the artemisias.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it depends on, we have annual, biennial, and perennial artemisia species, so figuring out which of those species would help with identification. Are you in a really sandy soil?
No, actually, it came in our air, in our property on some machinery that my partner uses in his logging business.
Oh.
That was from sandy soil.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably hand pulling is, or if it's not extensive, I would just go with hand pulling or repeated mowing. If it's the perennial, you know, it's going to be a challenge like goldenrod, but if it's the biennial, some hand pulling and getting a competitive desirable plants growing should be all that's needed.
Yeah.
So this is a really good reason for why you need to clean your equipment when you take it to or from any place, especially when you go like into the woods to do some logging or from your garden to somebody else's garden. Really important to clean your gear so you're not spreading any of these weeds or any earthworms that we'll be talking about later.
So pulling is, you know, without chemicals, that's probably the best. And pulling, so right, when did you say to pull again?
I mean, I think the key is to pull. It depends. If you think you can get the entire plant, it really doesn't matter when you want to pull.
Before it flowers. At least before it produces seed.
But if you think, if it's a perennial and you think you're going to break it off, probably a good rule of thumb is right when you start to see flower buds, that would be the ideal time. But I think usually we have more than we can ever pull in a year. So just getting after it as soon as possible is the best option.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Dave in Madison next. Dave, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have this bamboo-looking stuff that it won't die. I mean, I've sprayed it with the radioactive Roundup, and it makes it just a little sick, and it throws it off and keeps going. I've tried to dig it out, but, you know, like the roots are 18 inches down. How do you kill that stuff?
So we're talking about Japanese knotweed?
I don't know what it is. It looks like bamboo. It grows about 6 feet tall. It'll get about like an inch across with little segments like bamboo.
Yeah, I mean, we've actually done quite a bit of research on Japanese knotweed over the last 4 or 5 years. And if it makes you feel any better, Dave, you're not alone in this world in struggling to control this plant. It's really a challenge. We have tested a range of herbicides, and depending upon the environment of where this Japanese knotweed is growing, we can apply some herbicides and get 90 to 95% control for a year, year and a half. Then those populations start to come back. The challenge is many of the herbicides we're using are not available for a homeowner type situation. So where is this Japanese knotweed growing?
On the shady side of the house. Well, kind of in the front. I get like direct east facing. It's growing in the front and on the side.
Okay.
I also have some land up near Stevens Point that it's, and my dad tried for years and years and years to kill it off, but it's coming back again.
Right. So in these homeowner situations, I think really glyphosate is probably what you're going to have to hang your hat on. Our research has shown that if you can apply a brush rate of that herbicide, so read the label and see what the brush rate, because Japanese knotweed is considered a brush as far as management. And you can apply that in the fall to those plants. So right when it starts to flower around September 1st, you will get much better control. A lot of times those plants are super tall then, so we recommend that if you can mow it several months before and spray those resprouts, it's a lot easier to treat. But you don't need to if you want to just wait until the fall and spray it then. We've gotten, you know, upwards of 90% control, and you'll probably need to repeat that for 2 or 3 years to really get a handle on it.
Yeah,
it's really important with Japanese knotweed and other perennial species like this to understand how this plant grows. In this case, it's a clonal species, so the entire clump shares a root system. So if part of it is in your yard and part of it is in your neighbor's yard, you're not going to kill it if you work on your part and the neighbor doesn't work on their part. And it's just going to keep coming back and keep coming back. So it's really important to get that entire clump and any outliers that are coming out as well. And for people that have it near their foundation of their house, you definitely want to try to get rid of this because it's known to actually break through foundations of houses.
Oh, okay. There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Dave. Let's go to Kate in Stevens Point next. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Larry. I think my question was just answered. My neighbors have bamboo, and I live in Stevens Point.
Oh.
Yeah, chances are it's not bamboo. We do have a few bamboos that can survive in very protected areas in the Stevens Point area, but we don't have invasive bamboo in Wisconsin yet.
Well,
this is probably Japanese knotweed.
Well, probably.
Okay, it has moved from one neighbor to the next neighbor, and it is actually coming up through an old concrete slab.
That sounds like Japanese knotweed.
Yeah.
Does it have heart-shaped leaves or
I don't know.
Long, skinny
I have
grass?
Been close to it.
Okay. If it was bamboo, it would have more grass-like leaves, long and thin.
Okay. So, all right. Well, I listened to the previous caller, and I guess. Well,
you know what you got to do? You need to talk to the neighbors because you need to have all the neighbors need to work together on that.
Yes.
If they want to get rid of it. So.
Yeah, and Kate, I have a suggestion. We have a nice fact sheet that gives some detailed control information that's available if you just type in UWEX, that's okay. University of Wisconsin Extension and Japanese knotweed. You'll get it. You can download it. I suggest you hand it to your neighbor and say, see, this is bad. You know, let's see if we can do something about it. That would be my recommendation.
Well, thank you. And I love listening to you when you have these programs on with plants and all this.
Well, thanks, Kate. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Taking a look at invasive plants today with Kelly Kearns and Mark Renz. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we have a couple more guests from the DNR, and they'll be speaking about worms and other invasive species. We'll talk jumping worms for sure and some others as well, so stay with us for that. Right now, we're looking at invasive plants. Lots of invasives around our state with our two guests, Kelly Kearns from the DNR, Mark Renz from UW and UW Extension. So great to have them here today. And we'll go right back to the phones and to Jim in Pleasant Prairie. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for allowing me the opportunity. Anyway, to set the stage, so to speak, I live on a lot that's about 5 to 6 acres. And I only mow the areas closest to my house and the edge of the driveway, because I like to keep the most of my property in a natural state to encourage wildlife and natural setting. Okay, like, for instance, every fall I go out and look for buckthorn and European buckthorn, and I've got that under control. I realize that's something that's just an ongoing project, but I'm willing to do that, and I, you know, have that on an effective level. But what I'm calling about is that I have a species, which is a sandbar willow, and it is starting to take over close to half of the entire property, and it is so aggressive that I even notice, like this time of year when my lawn, part of my lawn, needs mowing, it's even invading that area. Now, I notice when they're really small, I can pull them out by hand. But if I could turn the calendar backwards, I wish I'd started controlling them when they were on a relatively confined to a relatively small area. But now, becoming more and more of a problem. The more mature ones are like as much as like 12 to 14 feet high, and I'm just wondering what your guests might suggest to control this.
All right. Kelly, we'll start with you.
Sure. So sandbar is one of our many native willows, and this one happens to be clonal. And so you probably have large patches that are all, share the same root system. And so, again, you need to knock back the entire thing to do it. It's going to be hard to actually kill these without using any kind of herbicide. But most people that do that manage properties like yours that are large and they're trying to keep them in a natural state is they use a combination of mowing and fire to keep those down. So mowing will knock them back temporarily. They will resprout. Fire will knock them back a little bit harder, and again, they will resprout. But most people will use fire every 2 to 3 to 4 years, depending on how quickly they're coming back, and to knock back those woody species. It's just a reality in this part of the world. If you leave an open grassland area open, it's going to get brushed in with some kind of brush. And so you just need to manage it. For a large area like that, it's really...
But you're not going to be able to mow down these 11-foot high ones.
With a brush mower. There are definitely equipment that, large-scale brush mower equipment, it's probably not something he'd be able to do on his own. He'd probably have to hire somebody in to do it. I don't know. How large is the diameter of the stems?
Well, I guess probably up to about 2 inches, But I notice in the public land in my general area, it's... There are areas where there are substantial stands of it there also.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, certainly, it's very common on a lot of Department of Natural Resources land. We don't have sufficient funds or staff to manage every acre that we own intensively. And so, and sometimes that's the desired state for some of our properties. So, yeah, and it's certainly not uncommon at all.
Would you go in if you can't mow or you don't have access to the equipment? Would you, mow it, cut it down, saw it down, whatever, and then glyphosate or something to it? Or what would you do, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, we have a range of options for controlling brush species using herbicides. There's what's called a cut surface or cut stump technique. That's what you're describing, Larry, where you cut the plant. And then soon after you cut it, you treat that cut surface with a concentrated herbicide, and that can be effective on a range of species. And then there's another method called basal bark, where you don't cut it, but you treat around the entire circumference, the lower foot to foot and a half, with a concentrated solution. And the positive of those is they're very targeted applications that you're limiting that application to other parts of the area. The downside is you're using a concentrated herbicide. If you have a lot of them, it's going to cost a lot of money to do. It's going to be expensive.
Yeah, 3 to 4 acres is a lot to do. It will take you a long time and a lot of hours in the field if you're going to be using those kind of methods of cutting. So, yeah, you're right. You should have started a couple years ago. But in retrospect, at this point, you need to maybe try a combination of different methods. And there are contractors that can come out and do this kind of work for you.
Yeah. For other people who say, geez, I wonder what this sandbar willow is like or some of these other invasives, you have the DNR has published, I think, a publication that shows invasive species. Now, I don't know that the sandbar willow is one of them, but...
No, the sandbar willow wouldn't be on there because that's a native species, but we have on our website fact sheets of all of our regulated invasive species, and they all have photographs as well.
Yeah, all have photographs. Good luck! Jim, thanks a lot for calling. Gary in Boscobel, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I got a couple of comments. One is I have the Japanese knotweed in a stream course, and the bad news is I've been chopping it off and then spraying it every year with Milestone for 17 years, and I'm still losing ground on it. And another thing that I've been aware of and deeply concerned about for as long as I can remember is these roadsides where township and county highway crews tend to mow all of these roadsides. It's really a bad time with the wild parsnip. It's always in seed. The sweet clover, it's in seed. And all these other invasive species that are along these roads, and they tend to use these invasive species seeds on every single nook and cranny of every town and county and state highway in the state. And it would be so easy if they would just be trained so that they would mow that stuff or spray that stuff when it was in flower rather than waiting till it's in seed. And it's so frustrating. And in my opinion, I think all of these road maintenance crews should be trained on what invasive species are out there and how to appropriately control them in a way that doesn't continue to spread them all over the landscape. It's just sad to see these invasive species show up on a roadside, and then in a year or so they're spread out into the fields or spread out into the woods and taken over. Our whole landscape, if you would vision a landscape with no non-native plants on it, the landscape would be about 90% bare. Probably all that would be native plants would be the trees and maybe a prairie remnant here or there, some woodland flowers. But for the most part, our landscape would be completely bare if we removed all the non-native plants that are on it.
Yeah. Kelly, a comment?
Yeah. So, you know, Gary, you're absolutely right, of course, about the roadsides. And we have been trying to train folks. It's kind of tough with having 72 counties and 1,000-plus townships that are all, you know, that don't necessarily get together and don't really have good opportunities for training. And so the highway managers, the superintendents of each county highways, have been given information about when they should be mowing. If they, for any of the state highways, they're supposed to be mowing by a certain mowing schedule and get it done by a certain time. So, for example, for the southern part of the state where you are, they are supposed to have all their mowing done by July 1st. Now, that's a little bit late this year, but in other years, that might have been early enough to get the parsnip cut before it bloomed. So, and it's also really tough if you have multiple species that are blooming at different times. You know, for example, hedge parsley is starting to spread a lot in the southwest part of the state, and it blooms later than parsnip. And chervil blooms earlier than parsnip, and garlic mustard blooms much earlier, and so it's already in seed. And if you're only going to be mowing once or twice, ideally they should be figuring out what's on their roadside and mowing for those primary species that they want to not stop spreading. Yeah. And we certainly would offer training if there are highway departments that are interested in getting their staff trained.
Yeah,
I'd just like to add that it's an ongoing issue. We do have regulated species in Wisconsin, and we have a law that says if they know that they're knowingly mowing these when they have viable seeds and not following best management practices, they can be held accountable for that. So, Gary, I would recommend if you see them doing that to report that to DNR because they are breaking a state law. And that's really the only way that some of these people are going to learn to start following these rules. The sad side is that their budgets have been cut so much that they're really limited on staff to be able to do this in some cases.
Yeah.
The thing that I find most effective is when people at the local level will contact their county highway department and especially their townships. And we found that in Iowa County right now, one of the counties actually adjacent to Iowa County, or towns, town of Vermont, has put some money into doing regular spraying on their mowed sites. They put an article in the paper, and now two other townships adjacent to them are interested in doing the same thing by having somebody do some contract work. So it's all because local people have brought it to their attention. And it's something that we can't do at the statewide level, but at the local level, you can bring that
make
to the attention of folks.
Yeah. All right. Dan in Evansville, we're on to you now. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I'm calling about burdocks and grapevines. I think they're grapevines. They're vines. They tend to kill my trees. The grapevines, I try to snip them off close to the ground, and I have some Tordon that I'll paint on what's left of the stump, and that seems to do good. And the burdocks, I try to use a spade shovel and get down as deep as I can and cut the root. But it just seems like a losing battle, and at this point I'm kind of surprised that everywhere isn't covered in burdocks and grapevines.
Yeah, Dan, that's a challenge, and these are two really common weeds. Probably the grapevines are probably native, and the burdock species could well be native as well, too. We have native and non-native versions. I think your techniques are correct techniques that are effective. It's just getting to all those species. I think the comment I'll make first about the grapevines is that Tordon is very effective, that using that cut stump approach I really like. The problem with Tordon is it moves very far through the plants and sometimes can cause damage to some of the nearby adjacent trees, particularly oak trees or others. So there's probably some other herbicides that you could use that have a little bit more safety in the forest that will limit some of that potential injury to some of the desirable plants.
Yeah, I don't want to do that then because it's growing up the trees. That's the problem. It'll kill a tree in a year or two.
Yep. Yeah. So I would look at some of the products that contain triclopyr, and you should get the same level of control.
Triclopyr? Okay.
Yeah, triclopyr, Garlon is one of the common products, and there's a whole range of those other ones. It's the active ingredient in the brush killer or poison ivy killer, that's the active ingredient.
Okay.
As far as burdocks, you're spot on. The shovel works really well. The key is I just get them when they're small before they form those nice big Christmas trees that they're starting to do now. It'll make it easier. There are a range of herbicides that work. Well-timed mowing works as well. It's just there's so many of them. That's the challenge. They germinate really early in the spring. And so if you can get really good grass cover, we've done research that shows that you can reduce the number of seedlings that germinate. If you can get a good, dense grass canopy and keep that grass 6 inches or taller, you'll get less of them that will germinate.
Okay.
And so try and keep that grass a little taller, particularly in April.
I was told that that big root is like a battery. And do you know how many times you have to cut them before it'll kill the root off?
That's a really good analogy, Dan. I didn't think of it. Yeah, so that it is like a battery. And so the key is if you can cut that spade below that battery or that shovel, you can actually do it with one cut. If you're going to mow it, you're going to have to mow it several times. The good news is that if you mow it and it's in second year and it's going to flower, if you mow it probably once or twice when it's bolting, so right around now, it may not die that year you're mowing it, but it won't survive to be the next year. So probably two mowings would be sufficient, depending on the timing when you mow it.
Right. It almost seems like be like an adaptable plant. It spreads out like underneath where the mower blades go, though, too. You know,
yes, it does. And so that's why to be most effective with mowing, we want to wait till like now where it's just starting to send up its shoot and it's probably around 3 or 4 feet tall. I've seen a bunch around on campus, unfortunately. And if you can mow
high level.
Yeah, you mow it now, it'll resprout and probably get to that level again. You might need to mow it one more time, but it'll die in the winter too. So you won't see it die during the summer or fall, but it won't survive to the next spring. But it's got to be already sending up that stem to be effective.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Sean in New London, on to you now. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for all your programs in Wisconsin Public Radio. I love it.
Thank you.
Larry, like many gardeners, I went to the garden centers this spring when I was expanding and working in my garden beds and bought some perennials, some I had owned before, to replant. Came home, happily planted them. Then I read some articles on invasive species in Wisconsin, and one article I read specifically mentioned butterfly bush and many of the Japanese spireas as not being native, and you should never plant them. And, of course, I sat looking at the two butterfly bushes I had just planted and promptly pulled them out and threw them away. And my question is, why do local garden centers in Wisconsin and nurseries carry and sell these kinds of things if they are invasive in Wisconsin, and we shouldn't be planting them in our garden beds?
Okay, I'd be glad to answer that one. So we have a pretty long list of regulated invasive species in Wisconsin, probably the biggest list in any state except for California. And so none of the species that are currently regulated as either prohibited or restricted are allowed to be sold at nurseries in Wisconsin, with some exceptions of cultivars and things. And however, both butterfly bush and Japanese spirea, we have not seen any evidence yet in Wisconsin that they have become invasive. It's pretty much in states to the south where there's been issues with that. And we really haven't had anybody report to us any true invasions of those species. And even in like northern Illinois, we really haven't seen that either. So we try to anticipate species that could become invasive, and that one just hasn't come up to the level of needing to be regulated yet.
Oh.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. We had, we've got an email from Jeff in La Crosse. He found a 5x5 foot patch of crown vetch in his 15-year-old prairie planting. He pulled flowering stems and hauled them away in his tractor bucket. He plans on spot spraying after regrowth, but wonders about how soon seed is viable after flowering. He doesn't want to spread it.
Yeah, and so that's a really good question. And, you know, first, kudos for getting after that crown vetch patch and trying to save your prairie. It can really take over the whole prairie. The time for when viable seeds are created is very specific to the species. So different, some species, it's right when those you see those flowers start to open, they can produce viable seed. And in other cases, it can be well till when those fruit are green and turning brown before viable seeds are made. I do not know off the top of my head, and I do not know if the research has been done with crown vetch, but if you got it just now, just recently, my guess is that you probably prevented any viable seed from being made with those plants that you pulled. The big challenge with crown vetch is it has a very hard seed, and so any seed that have been there from previous years, you're going to have to battle for years to come. So it's going to be a several-year, multi-year challenge and probably a decade of monitoring that site.
Well, here's a Facebook question from Andy. He says he helps manage a couple of conservation preserves in western Dane County, noticing a lot of bittersweet in them. Can you discuss the difference between an oriental and native bittersweet species? Do they hybridize? Should he just kill them all, or should he focus on the hybrid and oriental species?
Okay, so they're a little bit difficult to tell apart if they're not old enough to be producing flowers and fruits yet. Generally, the non-native will produce its fruits in the axils of the leaves. So where the leaf attaches to the stem is that axil. And towards the end of the stem, you'll have clusters of just a few fruits in each of those axils for, you know, maybe 5-10 leaves. Whereas the native typically just has its fruits at the end of each stem.
Okay.
And usually they're larger clusters. Once they're actually open, the natives are actually darker, deeper orange than the non-native. But the other thing, if they're not yet in flower or old enough to be producing fruit, is that the leaves on the non-native tend to be very rounded. It's called round leaf bittersweet, except for the new leaves are very tapered, just like the native species is. So it's a little tricky with those. There is some evidence that they are hybridizing. We don't necessarily haven't really necessarily seen a lot of that, but there hasn't been a lot of research on that as far as I know.
Has been some work done in Michigan in Indiana Dunes that's shown that there is hybridization that's occurring. And like hybridization, it's really tough. Some of those species are mostly the invasive, some are mostly the native, and some are a mixture. And so kind of the advice I give is that if you see a plant and it's really aggressive, a bittersweet, I would just get rid of it and just be proactive. But if it's just kind of sitting there and not doing that, and you're not sure if some of the characteristics are of what that native species are, I'd just keep an eye on it.
Let's go to Gail in Fish Creek next. Hi, Gail.
Hi. We did have a war on knapweed, and we have one. Now we just kind of scope our 16 acres and find a little patch here and there that might have sprouted up, and then we attack it. But that took us years. So I want to say don't give up for anything that anybody's going on. It is an effort. You think you're going to lose your mind, but eventually you win. And now we're going up against black medic. And we have tried just about everything. We've even had a landscaper come out and try different things. And that stuff just won't die. Help me.
Oh, boy. Black medic.
Yeah, it's
black medic.
It's a challenge, Gail. Can you describe what the environment is or the habitat of where it's getting in?
Well,
is it a prairie?
We've got nice prairie yard all around, and then we have this very large area, at least a 3-acre part of the whole property that is around the house. We even planted Nomo fescue, hoping to get like the thickness, that's where it keeps coming up.
Yeah.
In that, and then through our, where we have all of our flowers around the house, we have a big patch of a floral garden in that. And we'll have this, it'll come up, and then we have to kill it every year and kill it every year. And it just seems like, you know, as it's spreading, we're starting to lose our minds like we did with the knapweed. But there's also this little clover, and I've noticed the leaves are different in this clover that's coming up in our flower area where all our floral plants are, perennials, and where this yellow medic is starting to creep in too. but it's creeping in from where it was out where the Noma was, and that's a little bit farther out from the house.
Yeah, so I have a couple recommendations. So first, for the new species, I just recommend you send it in to the local county agent. Annie is the one up in Door County, and she can send a picture or a sample, and she'll get it identified or send it in to me, and we can take a look at it. Black Medic is a challenge. It's a challenge every year. It's well adapted, particularly to Door County, but I have it in my front yard, and it's a real problem as well. It can act as an annual or a perennial. It's one of those weird species, and I think probably the easiest solution is to use a herbicide early in the spring when you see it emerge. And I can give you some recommendations if you send me an email off the air. I don't know my turf herbicides as well, but there are some options to control it. And it just produces a ton of seed, and those seeds can spread. They have burrs and make it a challenge, and so all the animals will spread it everywhere on your property. So it's going to be a battle, Gail, I think is the short-term answer. But if you can get after it and really properly manage and fertilize that Nomo fescue, it should do a pretty good job of keeping it out once you get it under control.
Okay, well, they have been doing that, and we've had it in for many years now. And we just are like, they try some other herbicide and that, but we still keep getting it back. So it is going to be a struggle like it was with the knapweed.
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination. It's in the seed bank, and it probably you're controlling it maybe in the turf, but you're not controlling it in your flower beds, and then the bunnies are moving it back into your turf. And so that's some of the issues that we run into with spread. Unless you can get rid of all the populations, you know, you keep getting reintroduced. It's really common on our roadsides as well.
Oh, so now Larry's got chipmunks and I got rabbits that are screwing up my yard. And I send you pictures of the chipmunks because they're so adorable. And we have the rabbits. They clean off the snow salt off of my front steps, so I don't have to do that. They actually eat it all. So, yeah, so it's my rabbits that are causing the spread of my Black Medic.
I think so.
Oh, my goodness, the poor thing. I'm going to want rabbit for dinner. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And here we are. Boy, that 45 minutes flew by in a hurry. Kelly and Mark, it's been great. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Love to have you back. Maybe sometime we'll have you on for the whole 90 minutes, and I think that would be useful for a lot of people. Thank you so much.
Sure, Larry. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Kelly Kearns is the invasive plant coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR. Mark Renz with UW-Madison and a UW Extension weed scientist. So it's great to have both of them here, and they will be back. But we are going to turn our attention from weeds to worms and talk about earthworms in Wisconsin and perhaps some other invasive invertebrates as well, with our next two guests coming up on the Ideas Network.